Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain. Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter, dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
There's a new candidate for governor, a WEAC endorsement, a secret GOP redistricting plan, and Governor Walker is asked to talk with John Doe investigators. Rick Santorum is the big winner in the Republican presidential contest this week. President Obama continues to take heat on mandated insurance coverage of birth control. Some of the issues, the top state and national political issues that we will discuss in this edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, February the 10th. What issue from the news this week do you want to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Our Week in Review guests today are John Sharpless, Professor of History at UW-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Joe Winicky, former state senator, former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with state politics. There are two Kathleens now running for governor for a potential recall election for Governor Walker. Former Dane County executive Kathleen Falk had announced right away that she was in this race, but this week State Senator Kathleen Vinehout of Alma said she's also in the race. First, Joe Winicky, two Kathleens are in the race. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's got to be a first in the history of Wisconsin, at least.
Yeah, that's true. You haven't had two women.
Or two Kathleens.
Yeah. So is this it for the Democratic candidates?
No, I don't think so. I think there will be one or two other candidates. I have a sneaking suspicion that Mayor Barrett's going to get in this race at some point as well. And, you know, just to, you know, you always have to say you're an employee of the state. I do have to admit that Kathleen Vinehout, when I ran for party chair, nominated me, and I feel she's a very good lady. So I just want to throw in that I have some bias there.
All right.
I like Kathleen Falk as well. I've known her for many years.
But you're pretty sure that Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett will get in this race?
I haven't talked to him. I understand why he has to kind of delay, because he has to run for mayor right now. But, you know, my guess is that both Governor Walker and certainly Scott Fitzgerald are going to try and delay and delay and delay the inevitability of these recall elections. The latest one is Scott Fitzgerald is trying to argue that if somebody did ditto marks on a municipality, that they can throw that signature out, which is a bunch of hooey. You know, I mean, it's just made up malarkey. Yeah. But it's an attempt to obfuscate and delay. And I want them to prove where Adolf Hitler and Mickey Mouse signed.
Do you have any thoughts, John Sharpless, on the Democratic field so far in this recall election attempt?
I don't know either of these people very well. Joe can speak to it. It's been active in his party. I do know Kathy Falk to some extent. I don't think either one of them has broad state name recognition, and that will be important in this race because it's going to be a short, intensive campaign. Falk receiving the teachers' union endorsement will help. Not so much, I think, in terms of I don't know if those sorts of things change people's minds. People will vote as they please on that, but it will help with money. I'm sure they'll run ads for her, and that will help her. Tom Barrett, if he comes in, it would be an interesting race because obviously that would pit Walker, if he's successful in the primary, it would pit Walker against Barrett again. My complaint about Tom Barrett is not his politics. He's a wonderful man. He's just really decent. But he runs campaigns like a snooze. I mean, I've never seen a more relaxed guy about campaigning. He has this kind of he's almost walking in his sleep when he campaigns. And I think one of the reasons he did poorly against Walker was he just doesn't fire up. And people want to see a little fire out of their candidates. They want to see that candidate really, he's got to want it in front of them. And Tom has this, well, if you elect me up, I might show up.
John, I hate to do this to you, my friend, but it reminded me a little of this good guy who was a history professor who ran for office. You know, he was a very, very good guy. He knew the facts. He knew the issues. But the base doesn't necessarily get fired up by good guys.
True. John Sharpless ran for...
We ran in the same election.
That's right. Yeah. That's for second district.
So we got to know each other.
Yeah. So, well, I'm curious, Joe, what you think about this WEAC endorsement of Kathleen Fall. Why would WEAC endorse a candidate before all the candidates are even in?
Well, I think they're trying to impact who is the Democratic nominee, and they will have some impact because they have 100,000 members, roughly, and they also have money. There's something, and I don't know how this is going to read. I'm not getting involved endorsing anybody yet or anything like that. But one thing happened in this whole recall. Well, it actually began a year ago, I think, right about today, when the governor dropped the bomb, to use his words, and the protests started. And what happened that has never been involved in Democratic or Republican politics that I know of is literally several hundred thousand people got involved in elections and politics and recalls and things that had never been involved in anything before. And those people aren't used to endorsements from labor groups or business groups or, I mean, right now there was a story the other day. I used to be a realtor. I think it's a good organization. But now there's a group of realtors that are mad at the Realtors Association for supporting Walker. And it's because people that haven't been involved before are claiming ownership in the political process. And I think that's a good thing. But I also think that early endorsements, especially from a large group like that, will actually benefit, to some degree, Kathy Falk for the reasons John mentioned, money and the like. But also might galvanize those people who don't like the system into supporting some other candidate.
What about this pledge, though, that apparently Kathleen Falk signed that said she would veto a budget that retained the restrictions on collective bargaining rights or something along those lines? Was that responsible, Joe?
No. I hate to say that.
I don't know if that's legal, is it, Joe?
Well, I don't know how you do it because you don't know what the budget says or what's in it.
Yeah, I guess it was
it's a hypothetical.
Well, what she's looking for, I guess what WEAC was looking for was, you know, would they try to restore collective bargaining rights?
Well, look, every candidate in the world goes into these endorsements saying, what can I say that I am God's gift of the world to you? And no matter who, conservative, liberal, but I think it's an irresponsible statement, though I probably would veto a budget like that.
I have to say that when I had that moment in my life where I was interviewed, as Joe has been, by PACs and labor unions and business groups and alike, and it was very rare, extremely rare, that they asked me to pledge on a specific policy issue. What I found, in general, they want to see if you have an attitude about their area of public policy that's similar to them.
Well, you probably wouldn't have got these endorsements anyway, nor would I. Not the NRA or the pro-life groups.
Well,
you got to tell them point blank.
Actually, the NRA supported me, but it was what was interesting.
They didn't support me. I got an F-minus once.
Because I own guns and had spoken out on Second Amendment rights. But what was interesting about it is that they send you a little test in the mail. They all do. There's a questionnaire. And sometimes it's hundreds of questions. They're asking you how you feel about the weather. But others, it's a very short form. And with the NRA, it's 10 questions. So if you balk on one, all of a sudden you're down to 90%. And the issue, there were two that I just couldn't stand by. I wasn't going to repeal Brady.
Right.
First of all, it's a non-issue. It ain't going to happen. And number two, I didn't want unrestricted imports of foreign weapons. So all of a sudden, I was 80%. As a gunner and a hunter, I had failed the test. But I will tell you, when I actually talked to the NRA, they never asked me about a specific policy or piece of legislation, nor did the bankers. By the way, nor did the teachers when they interviewed me.
Actually, the teachers are not normally that restrictive on endorsements. Yeah, they have their issues. And, of course, collective bargaining is number one for any labor union right now.
Let's take a call from Connie in Columbus. Hi, Connie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. What I'm calling about is I received a postcard through the mail, and basically what it says is that there was a large number that they found questionable signatures on the recall petition against State Senator Scott Fitzgerald. He is in my 13th Senate district. What I have a problem with is not the fact that I signed the petition. I do believe he should be recalled, but the fact that they're using my name and address as a mailing, and also that it was sent via postcard, so anybody and everybody could read it, I just think that that doesn't show a lot of integrity.
Now, Connie, the postcard said, we took your name and address off of a recall petition. We want to make sure you really signed it, or something like that?
Correct. It says, so we wanted to ensure you did, in fact, sign the petition and that your signature was not added mistakenly or fraudulently. My name doesn't sound anything like Daffy Duck or any of the others. And I have a regular address, so I don't know why that should be targeted. It just seems as though they're using the recall petitions as a mailing list.
They can't under law. My guess, Connie, is that they've gotten your name off another list. And they're playing fast and loose here. They're trying to frighten you. That if the state election board has allowed these lists to be used for solicitation purposes, they're all under indictment. Isn't that correct, Joe? You're not allowed to use petitions as mailing lists.
I'm not sure I know the answer, but I know that this postcard was paid for by Scott Fitzgerald's campaign.
Yeah, and I did hear that this was happening, that the Fitzgerald people who were going through these petitions were supposedly sending postcards to those who signed
Sure.
Did you sign? We want to make sure.
Look, that I'm not sure they're all rocket scientists in that campaign. So, I mean, I look at that thing, and all they did was galvanize the people who signed the recall petitions against Scott Fitzgerald to be even more mad at him than they were before.
You should feel lucky, Connie. They could have sent your name to some company that would be calling you on an 800 number.
Yeah.
This is true. Could I read the entire postcard to you? Would that be okay?
Is it? Go ahead, if it's not too long.
It's postcard.
It's not too long. Dear 13th Senate District resident, we are sending this postcard to inform you that your name has shown up on a recall petition against State Senator Scott Fitzgerald. We have discovered a large number of questionable signatures through our initial inspection of recall petitions, so we wanted to ensure that you did, in fact, sign the petition and that your signature was not added mistakenly or fraudulently. And this is in bold. If you did not sign a recall petition against Senator Scott Fitzgerald between the dates of November 15, 2011 and January 14, 2012, please contact us immediately at 608-520-0745 or email us at contact@votefitzgerald.com. Thank you, Scott Fitzgerald, for Senate campaign team. www.votefitzgerald.com.
All right, that's good. That's good.
When I think of this, I think of the immortal quote from Forrest Gump, "Stupid is as stupid does." And that is just idiotic for Scott Fitzgerald to do that. It is crazy. Here's the thing. They keep saying, and Fitzgerald and the press, what press we have anymore, today is basically taking hook, line, and sinker, Scott Fitzgerald saying he has enough signatures invalidated to wipe out the recall. The reality is they had 3,900 more signatures than they need. And Scott, start campaigning because you're going to be recalled.
Well, you know, Scott Fitzgerald did say this week that he has at least 3,000 challenges to the signatures.
Well, he would need more than that.
Well, I thought he said it would bring him below whatever number would bring him below the threshold.
You know what part of it is? They're trying to argue that the recall should be on the next reapportionment. That's just nuts.
Yeah, but so that's what all of these senators are trying to do, though, aren't they? Trying to challenge signatures
I'd be interested what John thinks. I think they're showing a guide path to their future legal actions.
I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a campaign finance lawyer. It is my understanding that the petitions that are signed to put candidates on the ballot, petitions that are signed for referendums and for recalls, cannot be used for mailing purposes by campaigns. That's my understanding, that is illegal. Otherwise, they would mine those lists all the time.
And you may well be right. The reason I didn't confirm is I'm not sure.
Yeah. And I would like, and I'm the Republican here. I'm like Joe. I can't understand how stupid people could be. But this putting your name on this thing and telling everybody that it's a con job, you know, that we're associated with. But maybe I suggest to Connie, she should put this in an envelope with a short note to the State Election Commission and ask them whether or not it's legal to use these lists for campaign purposes.
And by the way, if you're correct, since they say in the postcard that your name is on a recall list, they're using the recall list.
Yeah. Or they may be. They may be. They may have done a blanket mailing on the assumption that they're going to hit the people that were on the list.
Let me thank Connie for the call. Let me get just a quick from both of you, just so, I guess, focusing in on the Senate recalls. Do you see any of those Senate districts turning, presuming there are recall elections? We have three others besides Scott Fitzgerald.
I think all four of them are three of them should be. One of them shouldn't be, and that's Fitzgerald. But if he keeps doing idiotic things like this, he may well find that his hubris is going to get him defeated. And sometimes voters, you know, and if that happens, it's very likely that district in the next election would go back to being a Republican district. But sometimes people send messages. They don't like what you're doing.
I think they're all, Joe knows more about the Senate, and when he worked for the State Democratic Party, I'm sure they've got hard numbers on how these various districts go. They all struck me as, until this happened, they are fairly safe candidates. Am I right?
No. And I'm in all seriousness, the Racine seat is very fickle. It has been many, many times. George Petak had it. Kim Plocke had it. Joe Stroll had it. John Lehman had it. Three of the last four senators were Democrats. The seat that Pam Calloway has in Wausau has been Democratic for 30 years. And the Moulton seat was last held by Pat Kreitlow, a Democrat from that area. That seat is about 50-50. These are all very, I mean, they were all, by the way, all three of those seats were Democratic losses in the 2010 Republican sweep. So I would argue that while the Fitzgerald seat shouldn't be in play, it may be in play because of his own blunderings. But the other three are very, could go either way.
We need to take a break. We will talk about other state political issues coming up after this break, including the secret redistricting plan, the latest in the John Doe investigation, and other issues in the news. Our guests are Joe Winicky and John Sharpless. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Joe Winicky and John Sharpless, and we're welcoming your input, too. What issue in the news this week do you want to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, let's talk about this this redistricting story that came out this week. Many Republican legislators reportedly signed a non-disclosure agreement, a sort of a pledge to keep it secret relating to redistricting. And a memo also came out that apparently instructed them to ignore any public comments that they received at public hearings. Joe Winicky, what do you think of that?
The gang that couldn't shoot straight. I the thought that they are saying that you should ignore the public in redistricting is, it's nuts.
Well, the fact that a memo is written that says that?
Yeah, and you're signing a confidentiality agreement. My guess is every single member of that Republican caucus signed it, because if there's one thing a legislator wants to know is what the boundaries of their next district is going to be. So they all looked, and in order to take a peek, they had to sign this. Now, this Eric McLeod, or whatever his name is, this attorney, and, you know, he's involved in all these legal actions. I'm told he's a good attorney, but this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, does it make sense to you, John Sharpless?
Well, nothing's secret in modern politics. It's that simple. And the notion that they thought they could keep this quiet and the public wouldn't find out about it. But this pushes a button with me. It doesn't, not the particular secrecy pledge, but the whole politics of reapportionment and redistricting, one for Congress and one for the state houses, is absolutely corrupt. It's been corrupt for more than 100 years. I can't believe that Americans tolerate this crap. We need a constitutional amendment. This needs to be a nonpartisan commission like Iowa has. You can have computer-generated programs that look at, take into account boundaries and demography, and you can produce a map that is absolutely neutral to either party. We need to do that. We need to do it soon. The problem is there's always a decade between these moments. It doesn't matter if Democrats rewrite the map or Republicans. It is a disgrace. And it means that you create a bunch of pocket districts where candidates don't have to seriously, and I will tell you, even if they're in your own party, they don't have to seriously respond to their constituents because, in general, they will always be elected, barring some horrible moment in political history or some indiscretion that's appalling. They don't have to do a thing. This is one of the most corrupt aspects of American politics.
Mm-hmm. Fired up over that one. Do you think so too, Joe?
I agree 100% with John. And for anybody who wants to look at a community that just got completely distorted, go down to the village of Oregon, 7 miles outside of Madison, because they didn't use ward lines or anything. And that boundary line snakes through. It doesn't even keep parts of communities together. It's like they needed to get a number to fit. And they don't care at all about communities of interest, ward lines. I don't know how people are going to vote and how these election officials are going to figure out how they vote in these things. It's just, this should be taken out of politicians' hands.
I don't want to press this issue further, but it's a personal issue with me. I came very close to beating Tammy Baldwin, and I would have run against her again, and I think I would have won. And, I mean, that's just speculation, but I came within one half of 1%. And they protected her by gerrymandering the second district in appalling ways. And what they did was to give Paul Ryan a district that would keep him in Congress forever. And the trade-off is they gave Tammy Baldwin a district that would keep her in Congress forever. And I didn't run because it became impossible. I don't know if anybody's looked at the second district, but it goes down and it skirts Janesville.
Yeah, it goes to Boyd.
Because that's Paul Ryan's. He owns it. And then it hooks around and picks up Beloit. It's goofy. It's a fishhook.
Yeah. And what's even worse, John, the 2002 map that took you out of that race, and I don't dispute a thing he just said, that 2002 map was agreed upon by the Democratic members of Congress and the Republican members of Congress. They, and I know how this works, Obie and everybody else and Sensenbrenner and all the different guys came in. It was an incumbent protection plan. And when both parties agreed, it became law. It's crazy.
It's really interesting, but we do have callers and other issues that we need to get to. So we'll pick up on a separate hour on how to change our redistricting process. Dave in Wanakee is with us. Hello, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I was reading about Scott Walker offering to come in to talk to the prosecutors, and I assumed he was offering to come in to show that he's got nothing to hide and that the truth will, you know, show that he's a straight-up guy. Why does he need a couple of lawyers with him? Won't the truth suffice?
All right, so yes, in the news this week, the governor has retained two criminal defense attorneys, and he had said he was going to voluntarily speak with the John Doe investigators. Then he was pressed this week and said, well, actually, the Milwaukee County DA asked me to talk. So he is going voluntarily, but he was asked to talk about this John Doe investigation. John Sharpless, what do you make of this?
I'd have lawyers there. following my campaign, and we only raised $500,000, and I won't go into the politics behind this. My campaign was audited over an absolutely trivial matter, and I wished that I had had a lawyer. I'm going to tell you, campaign finance law is complicated, and it depends on how you read it. In the case of my particular error, which was completely honest, we were allowed under the law to do it, but we weren't allowed to do it under the regulations. Absolutely, Walker would be a fool not to have lawyers there. It says nothing about his guilt. Dave, the caller, I have a question for you. Are you saying anybody who shows up in court or talks to a prosecutor with a lawyer must be guilty? Having a lawyer with her says nothing about guilt. It's just something you really need in America. And it's that simple, and it says nothing about whether the governor is guilty or not.
Absolutely. He also made a point of saying that this was taxpayer funds we're not going to be paying for. Two lawyers. Of course they're not.
Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to – John and I agree too often, but not on this one. Scott Walker did the usual political thing at around 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. He sends out some statement saying he's voluntarily agreed to talk to the Milwaukee County District Attorney, who's in charge of the John Doe. All weekend, the spin is he's doing this on his own. Well, come Monday, they admit. And look, I got called – and the similarities – to the caucus scandal of 8 or 10 years ago that ensnared Jensen and Burke and Quala and Foti and those guys are just amazing on this one. Well, I got subpoenaed, and I could have just voluntarily came in. I did, but they sent me a subpoena. Monday, we find out that they had made the initial contact. So I'm sure the district attorney said, well, you can come in voluntarily or we'll subpoena you. And so Walker spun it that he's coming in voluntarily, but the only reason he is if he didn't come in voluntarily, they would subpoena him. And it's too cute by half. And, you know, that, but the other thing is, it's lawyering up is one thing, and usually they just hire Michael Best and Friedrich. That's what Republicans do. In this case, they also hire, he didn't even hire a Wisconsin lawyer. Of course, he bought his Christmas presents online from out of state too, so whatever. But he hired an expert in grand juries from Chicago. Now, if you're going to just lawyer up, that's one thing. But if you're going to lawyer up with an expert in grand juries from Chicago, that tells me you're more nervous than just saying, oh, we're going to respond to a couple emails.
Also this week, a former Walker aide, when he was a Milwaukee County executive running for governor, did enter a guilty plea in court this week. She has also agreed to cooperate with the investigators. Is this
that's the peril? That's the peril. Okay, go ahead, Jen.
I don't know if the. Let me begin by saying I don't know if Scott Walker was directly involved in this. My guess is what he's going to do is say. And this actually is as much of an indictment of being, I was surrounded by people breaking the law, but I didn't. And then you ask him, Scott, your choice of these people, right? I mean, you chose them. But he's going to say, I was surrounded by malfeasance, and I'm completely innocent. And the next argument that's going to be very important in this is that they're not really bad people. They were just overly enthusiastic about their love of their candidate. And you've heard that before.
Yes.
And there was a lot of that in the Koala thing. These aren't bad people. They didn't really mean to break the law. They just were working hard for their party and the candidates they loved. Now, it turns out it is against the law, and you give a nod to nobody should break the law. But what you're going to do is you're going to have these people be seen as just enthusiastic workers on a campaign. The little breakdown here, and it's already happened with this person, is once you get a person who will cooperate, and whether or not they are sentenced and fined or do jail time, those are the people that suddenly will point fingers. And it happens inevitably with these kinds of situations.
That's the parallel to the caucus scandal. In the end of the day, they weren't going after the smaller fish lieutenants. Harry Truman had it right. The buck stops here. You hired these people. And the thought that you could have in some console somewhere, some secret router going on 15 or 20 feet from the county executive's office in his private area, and he not know about it when they did thousands of these, you hit it on the head. Either he is incompetent or he's guilty. And one or the other, it's against the law.
Well, it's not, unfortunately, in politics, it's not against the law to be incompetent.
No, the other part. Yeah, fair point.
Yeah, and again, the against the law part is that these aides were accused of and one pled guilty to
campaigning on public time, on taxpayer dime.
Yeah. Speaking of taxpayer dollars, we heard yesterday the Legislative Fiscal Bureau released new figures. The state budget condition is worsening, $143 million budget deficit is projected for 2013. The governor says no budget repair bill. He'll find that money in waste, fraud, and abuse. Think so, Joe?
Well, tell the waste, fraud, and abuse line. I'll cut him some slack on this one. In a $60 billion biennial budget to be off by $140 million, every governor goes through this. Sometimes you're lucky and you got more. Sometimes you're unlucky, you got less. It shouldn't be too shocking when for six straight months we've had job losses that our revenue estimates were down.
Okay. We also, this is, comes back to Scott Walker. He forced the layoff or retirement of hundreds of state employees, county employees, all across the state. Those people stopped paying taxes. Republicans are in a dilemma. They hate the public sector as an area of expenditure. But the truth is, if you cut the public sector, you got a lot of people without jobs. I mean, that's just
The roughly 100,000 people in this state that all took 8% pay cuts, roughly, because of the pension and health care changes. That's less disposable income. You're not buying as much.
And you're not buying, and you're not paying as much tax on that. So you were going to have a short – but I want to agree with Joe here. And I just hate agreeing with Joe.
Why could we do it too often?
Just about every governor has been surprised. Sometimes they're surprised positively. They look at the budget a year out, and they go – hey, I've got lots of extra
Tommy
money.
Tommy Thompson was lucky as could be.
I've got extra money. Sometimes you look at it a year out and you go, why didn't anybody tell me we were going to have this shortfall? So I don't think the Democrats, if they're smart, they'll make an issue out of this. But I'm not sure it really is Scott Walker's fault that he came up short.
It's a relatively small number in the realm of things, believe it or not.
Let me take a quick break, and we're going to talk about some national issues coming up after this break, and we will have our Week in Review quiz. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Joe Winicky and John Sharpless. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Time for our Week in Review quiz. The Packers didn't make it to last weekend's Super Bowl, but there was a Wisconsin connection in the broadcast. A Wisconsin image appeared in an ad that got a whole lot of attention. We are wondering, what was the image and what was the ad? What ad was this image in? That's the question. We'll give you about 5 minutes or so to call in your guess. We will pick a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will win a fabulous book that we featured on the program recently. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We will reveal the answer, and we will talk a little bit about that ad and that issue, too, at the end of the program. Let's turn our attention to national politics, and how about the GOP race for president? Rick Santorum won all three of the contests this week, which surprised some people. They thought he might win Minnesota and Missouri, but not Colorado. What do you make of Rick Santorum sweeping these contests, John Sharpless?
Well, it's a great moment for Santorum. I think he'll get a fundraising boost out of it. He's going to get some. The media is so fickle, you know, the camera will turn to him now and people will follow him around where they did it to Gingrich for a while. And and occasionally the media, which is rather tired of Romney, will show up at a Romney. A couple of things. I think particularly Missouri and Minnesota. Colorado is a tougher case. And if I was the Romney people, I would be a little concerned about that. Minnesota and Missouri were environments in which just beating the pavement would make a difference. Just showing up, eating the bad food, shaking hands, saying you love to be there. And Santorum did that. And most of his opponents didn't. And I think those victories go to hard work on the pavement. They weren't states that were driven by big media, see. So he has not done well in big media states. The second part of this is in the final analysis, very few delegates were allocated on the basis. Neither Minnesota nor the Missouri race has much to do with delegates. What will happen later, delegates will be selected, but the party is supposed to look at those beauty contests to make a difference. Colorado's another case. I think Colorado was really, it was a truly primary election. He'll have this moment. One final thing on this. The way it bounces around says that none of these candidates have a consistent draw with Republican constituencies across the country. I will come back to what I've said before on the show. It will end up being Romney, not particularly because he's the best candidate, but in the final analysis, I think he's the man that the business Republican community wants there. These other candidates are not the kind of candidates that Wall Street would like. And the second thing is, this is very important for Romney, and I think it's one of the reasons why McCain didn't do well. He will be everybody's second choice. And that means in the election against Obama in the fall, you won't have a kind of burning commitment to this man that they are going to need if they're going to defeat an incumbent president. No matter, we could have an interesting thing in the fall. We could have an incumbent president who in the polls is below 50%, but he wins the election by 5%.
Or more.
You agree with that assessment?
I do largely. The thing I'm not 100% sure that Romney will be the nominee, but it's the logical guesstimate. But what I also see is I see social conservatives who are out of the mainstream of society, but within the mainstream of like a caucus vote, galvanizing around Santorum. I see more of the populist conservative wing still with Gingrich, the so-called ideas guy, and I see Romney with the traditional Republican base. But that tells me you go into Super Tuesday, the social conservative stick with Santorum. I would bet dollar to a donut that Newt Gingrich is going to make a roaring comeback in the South on Super Tuesday, and this thing's going to last a while. But at the end of the day, I still think it's going to be Romney.
I don't know what happens at the convention. We haven't had a divided convention in American history for a long time. As a historian, I would love it. I can tell you, as a Republican, it will be the kiss of death.
Oh, yeah.
if these guys are slugging it out on the floor of the convention, and this thing is settled in the back room, it's out of 1920 and Warren Harding again. You're just not supposed to do that anymore. It's a kind of old politics that shows up in the movies, but it's not supposed to really
happen. And in those days, John, you only had a handful of primaries. Yeah. And so it could go to a brokered convention. Yeah. Now virtually every state has a form of you know, moving delegates.
If this is mean and nasty on the floor of the convention, this will be more fun than a Super Bowl. I mean, you'll sit there with your popcorn and you'll watch this convention, and there'll be people who are slugging it out in the aisles between delegations. I suspect Republican the core of the party will not let that happen. They will try to ease these differences as they move toward the convention, and they will pick a candidate who will, I suspect, unless the economy takes a big turn for the worse or there's an international crisis, I think we're going to have a president whose popularity is below 50% win a national election.
On another issue in the news this week, President Obama, the White House, has been under fire for this rule that would require employers, including religious organizations, to offer health insurance that covers fully birth control coverage. The Catholic Church very, very upset about this. In the news this morning, ABC is reporting that later today, the president himself will likely announce some sort of compromise, some sort of accommodation to appease the religious groups, but it's not clear exactly what that is. Joe, did the president make a mistake here? Did he turn off Catholic voters? Was this the wrong thing to do?
Well, I think he turned off some of the bishops. 98% of Catholics, according to polling, use birth control. Well, now a handful of old white men are going to tell 98% of the Catholics that if they have a health plan that has got any affiliation with the Catholic Church, that they shouldn't be able to get birth control. I think this is one where the president will get a lot of media pushback, but the public's on his side.
Mm, you think so, John?
The vast majority of Catholics voted for Obama the first time, and he was outspokenly pro-choice. The notion that American Catholics are mindlessly obedient to the contraception issue is just, it's a silly stereotype. It's just, as Joe says, the majority of Catholics use some sort of birth control. I think this is a little furor. I'm sure he'll negotiate his way through it. And when we get to fall, nobody will remember this. This is just a little. This is nothing.
It's this week's rule.
Ned in Wausau wants to talk about it, though. Hi, Ned.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to just give a typical example of how this affects people that work at either Catholic hospitals or universities. By the way, I congratulate you on having two good guests this week.
They're excellent.
I've never agreed with both guests more than this week that I can ever remember.
That doesn't say much about us, John. Huh?
So congratulations to Wisconsin Public Radio. The topic now, I think that if you look at a professor who teaches at Notre Dame University, she may be Catholic or she may not. Now, let's say that she's a Catholic, as one of the guests said. There's a 98% probability that sometime during her reproductive year, she's going to be using modern methods of contraception. And if she's not Catholic, then either way, why should the hierarchy of the Catholic Church have their will imposed upon the majority of people that work for, let's say, Notre Dame University? That is just ridiculous. It isn't a matter of being Catholic and being imposed upon that you must use contraception. By no means. That's not what we're talking about here. The problem is who's going to pay for it, and if we're going to cover Viagra or any other type of system for men, why can't we have a modern contraception included in health insurance coverage for all people that work for systems in which there's a mixture of people, because the president made an exception for employees of the Catholic Church directly. These are those associated with the Catholic Church.
Well, what kind of a accommodation, Joe, do you think the president could say today that will appease the Catholic Church?
Delay.
No, he's got another. There's another scheme here, and I'm not sure Catholic hospitals and health plans will be comfortable with it, but you would set up an ancillary add-on insurance program that would deal solely with birth control. In my case, my plan doesn't cover dentistry, but I can pay for an additional dentistry plan.
That's possible.
And so what that would mean that the and there would have to be some matching there, but the church could feel that it's at arm's length now and that most of that plan is paid for by the recipient. And that might be a comfortable way out. There's some bookkeeping involved there that's a little irritating. There's something that can I elevate this, though, to a larger issue about federal mandates and health care? I fully believe that it's good public policy and it's also humane to provide adequate family planning to women in America and across the world. But there is a question about whether you can mandate to religious groups various kinds of procedures and drugs and aspects of medical care which violates their basic beliefs. I mean, we have to be very careful. This is a – people can rally around contraception, but if the – and I don't mean to demean this issue, but if the American Pork Growers Association convinced the government that everybody should have a lamb chop, if you had a hospital that was run by either Jewish Americans or Middle Eastern Americans, and they were forced to serve lamb chops.
Pork chops.
Yeah.
Wrong animal.
That would be wrong. All right. So that's the ridiculous extreme.
Yeah.
We can all rally around contraception. But in between there is a philosophical issue. In the case of health, certain kinds of procedures and drugs and regimens can run directly counter to people's religious beliefs. Yeah. And can Washington bureaucrats tell them that they must do it?
Well, good food for thought.
It's ethic. It's the morality of ethics. And John's right. There are issues here. I must say one thing. I got a great kick out of Ned, I think it was, from Wausau. He was talking about contraceptives and then bringing up Viagra.
Well, that's some plans cover Viagra.
I know, but I was thinking of contraceptives and well, never mind.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of funny.
We have to talk about a couple of other pieces of news on gay marriage this week. A court overturned California's Proposition 8, which banned gay marriage, and Washington's legislature approved a gay marriage bill. So, what is the tide turning on this one, Joe?
I hope so. you know, essentially, if you get, we've been spending a lot of time talking about religion in the last few minutes. Essentially, marriage is a legal contract. And why it should only be a legal contract between men and women and not other loving couples, you're dealing with your property rights and all the other issues there, and it's a contract. It's contract law.
So this is where my libertarian streak comes out. The government got to get out of the marriage business.
Yeah.
Completely. I don't think there should be any state sanctioned recognition of marriage whatsoever. We should be concerned about children who are dependent. And we should be concerned about those dependent children, whether they're in a marriage or not in a marriage. We should be concerned about their health and their welfare and their safety and their education. As to the couple who claim to be married, I don't think they deserve a special tax rate. I don't think they deserve special privilege with health care programs. I think the state ought to get out of the business. We've come to a time in our history in which marriage is something that has to do with the religious side of our lives. If you want to be married by a priest or a guy wearing a robe and standing in the woods, that's your business. The state of Wisconsin, the United States of America, should not be in the marriage business,
and
period.
Just to touch on that, my brother Bill has been a minister for 40-some years. He's told me many times, all of that wedding stuff, the service and the vow, is just for show. The only thing that really matters is he's legally authorized, along with the couple, to sign the document.
That's my libertarian side. I don't think there should be tax benefits. I don't think that there should be benefits in any way whatsoever for a couple that carry that title. And this doesn't have to, it doesn't matter if they're gay or they're straight, if they're black or white. I don't care what they are.
Young people understand this.
It's time now for us to talk about that Wisconsin image that appeared in the ad that got all that attention this week. We asked in our Week in Review quiz, what was the image and what was the ad? Congratulations to Adam, our winner of the quiz this week. He said it was a photograph of Wisconsin protesters at the state capitol in a Chrysler ad that featured Clint Eastwood. I wanted to talk just a little bit about that ad first. It got a lot of attention. It made the case for optimism about the country and about Detroit. Karl Rove and others criticized the ad as an endorsement of President Obama. Others disagreed. Briefly, since we're so close to the end of the hour, John Sharpless, was that an endorsement of President Obama by Clint Eastwood?
I like the ad. We sit through the Super Bowl ads. I found that really a moving ad. I had a little tear in my eye. I love Clint Eastwood. I love the gravelly voice. I love the black and white. I love the idea of people struggling to make their lives better. I like the idea of America being on the edge of a reformation. I'm a very political guy. I didn't see any politics in that ad. I thought it was about Ram trucks when it all got done. And Rove and that bunch better just shut up on this issue.
Clint Eastwood?
Clint Eastwood is one of the few celebrities who's a Republican, and he's deeply loved by the good old boys of the party, the hunters and fishermen types like me. He's one of our icons, and Karl Rove can just shut up on Clint Eastwood. He's a hell of a lot better man than Karl Rove.
You know, the picture, the photo that was in the ad also was photoshopped. A union sign was changed to look like a different sign. We don't have time to go into why this happened, but
they took off the Colonel Hegg fell at Chickamauga, too. But, this is just lunacy, this whole thing. I mean, that ad truly didn't, even Chrysler as much. It reminded me of Reagan's Morning in America. And that's why it was halftime in America, but it was that positive thing. If our politics have gotten so down in the gutter that we can't celebrate a rebirth of America, shame on all of us.
Well, we're going to have to leave it for now. All right. Joe Winicky, thank you. John Sharpless, thank you for being here. Joe Winicky, former state senator and former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. John Sharpless, professor of history at UW-Madison. We're going to have more on state politics coming up in our state capitol report on Monday between 7 and 8, so I hope you will join us for that. Thanks to Rob Ferret, to Amanda Magnus, and to Bill Martins for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.